Greetings to the brightest audience in the country. I am Bob Enyart, the pastor of Denver Bible Church. This is Theology Thursday. Typically, we look at the news of the day from a Christian worldview. Today, we look at the source of the Christian worldview, God's Word.
The book of Genesis. In 6 days, God made the heavens, the earth, the sea, and everything that's in them. What if we want to look at it scientifically? Obviously, not everyone believes in the Bible, but science is something you could attempt to demonstrate to someone, to test, observe, try to prove, establish, look, this is reasonable. But what if we looked at the question of the earth, and we asked, is there any way through scientific observation, through measurement, to try to determine how old the earth is? Well, it turns out that there are literally hundreds of ways to try to date the earth. They're called geochronometers, and this science of dating the earth had been around for hundreds of years, and it only really, actually just a couple hundred years, but with evolution, the different geochronometers, ways of dating the earth, they mostly showed a very young age of the earth, like not in the millions of years or billions, but in thousands. But then evolution came along, and they said, you know, evolution would happen gradually and slowly, and it can't possibly happen in 6,000 years, or 10, or 50, or 100,000. We need millions of years, maybe billions. So the Earth must be billions of years old. So they set up this geologic column with these different eras in it, and they figured out, well, we have Cambrian layer in the rock, we have Precambrian, we have the Jurassic era. How long ago did each of these layers in the geologic column get laid down? How long were the different periods and stages of the Earth? So they came up with the ages for these things, and today kids in school are taught, well, we know how old these things are because we have radiometric dating, and we use uranium decay and potassium argon, and we figure out when elements decay, we see how fast do they decay and how much of the decayed element is in that rock. And then we measure it and we figure out how old it is. And you think, wow, that's how they figured out the geologic column, right? That's how they figured out that Jurassic Park was 65 million years ago. No, that's not how. Because they set the ages for the geologic column before they ever did radioactive dating, before they ever did it. And when they radioactive date something, they come out with dates that are wildly divergent from what they expect through the evolutionary theory. So you know what they do? They calibrate the radioactive dating for that instance, and they say, well, we were off. We had to throw out the parts of the specimen that were not good. We had to redo it 6 or 7 times, and we came up with the right date. The right date being the one that fits the evolutionary timescale. For example, in Hawaii, there are many recent volcanic flows, and they took a rock from 1801. And if you were to try to go to Hawaii and ask, well, this lava bed that we're hiking through, when did it erupt? Well, that erupted in 1925. Take a rock from it and go to a university and say, would you guys date this for me? What does it cost to date a rock? I'll pay. Now, does it cost $500? $3,000? What does it cost? I'll date. Let me know when this rock solidified, because that's what their dating supposedly does. It tells you when the rock became a rock, when it went from molten or gaseous or whatever and was compressed and solidified to rock. You say, would you date this for me? And what they will tell you is no. They will not date it for you. If you offered to pay, they will not date it for you. Why? Because they've been embarrassed too many times. They'll take a lava rock from a flow in 1801 and date it to be over 1 billion years old. You say, well, it's less than 200 years old. Well, we have to recalibrate. And so what they do is they'll only date rocks for evolutionary scientists, paleontologists, and others who give them a complete description of where they found the rock, what fossils they found with the rock, what the rocks in the strata above and below have been previously dated, where's the published material, and they give them a number of samples, and then they start testing. And some of the samples, the results are bizarre, from a few thousands of years to a billion years. So that's no good. So we keep throwing out parts of the sample until we come up with the date that we need. So the age of the Earth that children are taught in schools today, 5 billion years old or billions of years old, that is a fabrication based on a preconceived notion called evolution. What if we were to look at the geochronometers that are not based on an assumption of evolution, but just go out and try to figure out using our minds, reason, scientific method, how old is the Earth? What if we look, for example, at the amount of dust, just dust, that enters the Earth through our atmosphere from the solar system? Dust from meteorites. Well, there's a lot of dust that comes into the Earth every year and settles eventually on the surface of the Earth or in the oceans. Scientists have done calculations to try to figure it out right as close as they can, how much dust. Now, pretty much, if they do this work and they do a good job of it and it's published in the scientific literature, they may not revisit it every year. Why recalculate? They've figured out an amount that they believe is pretty reasonable. Well, if we go back to the Scientific American in 1960, February, page 132, we find out that there is a scientist named Hans Petersen who calculated that about 14 million tons of meteorite dust per year settles on the surface of the Earth. 14 million tons per year. Now, if the Earth has been here for billions of years, as the evolutionary scientists tell us, you know how much meteorite dust there should be on the Earth? There should be a layer of 182 feet of meteorite dust around the Earth. And then people said, well, maybe that dust really, see, that dust just got sort of integrated into all the other elements we have on the crust of the Earth. Well, how about the nickel in that dust? Because meteorites are made up of about 2.5% nickel. But nickel is tremendously rare on the Earth. Tremendously rare. It's just not possible that we have millions or billions of years of dust from the solar system falling on the surface of the Earth. That has not happened. So what happens when you have a model of the universe and a model of the cosmos, the world around you? We have the biblical model, Christians do, who believe that God created the Earth in the recent past. And evolutionists and atheists have a naturalistic model that the Earth, the universe has been here for billions of years, the solar system for billions, the Earth for 5 billion years or more. And then both models should be able to explain what we find around us. As we go out and investigate the world and see what it's like, the models should predict what you'll find. And then when you do find things they hadn't predicted, the model easily explains. So the creation model from the Bible predicts that you will not find millions or billions of years of sediment from the solar system falling to the Earth. But the evolutionary model doesn't predict that. It predicts the exact opposite. Just like NASA had feared when they went to the moon, that the moon would be hundreds of feet thick in dust. And so if you look at photographs of the lunar landing module, what do the feet that it landed on look like? They're pods. Look like they're covered with aluminum foil. They're these pods. And why did they put those pods there? So that it would not sink into the dust. Armstrong, one of the things he stated, is one of his greatest fears in walking out and stepping on the moon was sinking in the dust. They really thought there would be well over 100 feet of dust because they believed it was there for 5 billion years. Now they say, well, our calculations were wrong, and there's not that much dust, doesn't settle. But they've done these calculations and estimate the amount of dust entering the Earth, and it's not there. Now, where can we go from there? What if we look at the ocean? The ocean has nickel in it, the element nickel. We can measure how much nickel is in ocean water, and that has been done very carefully by many scientists. We can go to the bottom of the ocean and say, was there a lot of nickel down there in the basement of the ocean, in the sediments or in the rock beneath it? No, it's just like the rest of the world. So we have some idea of how much nickel is in the ocean. But guess what? There's nickel in the Earth, in the crust of the Earth, and it rains. And rains, eventually, water from beneath the crust and the rains form into lakes or rivers, and rivers eventually run off into the oceans. And those rivers carry nickel into the ocean. They carry nickel into the ocean. What if the ocean, when it was originally created, and think of the absurdity of the ocean being created out of an explosion. It's a pretty strange idea. But just imagine when the ocean was primordial, brand new. Imagine if it had no nickel in it whatsoever. Now it had all the other minerals in it, but no nickel. That would be a little weird. But imagine if it had none. How many years would it take the rivers of the world to bring the ocean to its current capacity of nickel? You follow what I mean? When the rivers flow, they pick up minerals from the crust of the earth. One of those minerals is nickel. So the rivers bring nickel to the ocean. How many years would it take if the ocean started with no nickel whatsoever to reach its current level concentration of nickel? It would take approximately 9,000 years. 9,000 years. You know what the evolutionists have to do? They have to go out and have to find 5 billion years worth of nickel. 5 billion years, because somehow, it could be aliens, but somehow it's missing. Perhaps Art Bell is right, and people from another galaxy came to mine the Earth and took all the nickel. 750 million pounds of nickel each year are carried to the oceans from our river systems. That is not the only mineral that is carried to the oceans, is it? There are so many minerals, and we could repeat that test, that geochronometer. We'd say, okay, how much sodium is in the ocean? How much magnesium, silicon? Well, there are scientists who have done this. In fact, published a journal, a periodical, called Chemical Oceanography, published by the Academic Press in London. Scientists have calculated, and I'm getting this data out of a book called Scientific Creationism by Henry Morris, who also, by the way, wrote a commentary on Genesis, which is just great. These scientists estimated, what if the ocean had zero minerals to start with, and all the minerals were brought to it from the rivers? How long would it take to accumulate the current level of sodium, that salt? The oceans have a lot of salt in them, right? 260 million years, a quarter of a billion years for the salt, if there was none to start with. Magnesium, 45 million years. How about silicon? We make computer chips out of silicon. There's silicon in the ocean. 8,000 years, and the rivers would bring all the silicon to the ocean. Copper, 50,000 years. Gold, 560,000 years. Mercury, 42,000 years. Wow. This is pretty interesting. Different scientists have done these calculations, and they come up with not exactly the same figures, but figures within the ballpark. So isn't that a nice, neat little test for how old are the oceans? How old is the Earth? We could look at volcanoes. Volcanoes flow. How many volcanoes a year do we have? Well, we have about 12 active volcanoes a year. And if we look at the average flow from a volcano, right, what we're going to consider is the crust of the Earth. And how long did the crust of the Earth take to get here? Now, geologists, evolutionists, tell us The Earth took a billion years to cool down, about a billion years. Then it cooled, and there was the crust. And then since then, the crust has grown a bit because we've had volcanoes. And they pull up molten rock, magma, from under the crust of the Earth, and they shoot up into the Earth on the surface or even up into the atmosphere, fall back down, and sort of the crust of the Earth gets a little thicker. It grows. Well, what if the volcanoes, were there more volcanoes or fewer as we go back in history through the millions of years and billions of years? Well, the Earth has been settling, cooling down, calming down. So these things, there would have been more meteorites billions of years ago than there are today, so there would have been more dust. And there would have been many more volcanoes if their model of the history of the Earth is correct than there are today. But let's just assume there was as many as there are today. How long would it take for today's lava flows to completely create the Earth's crust? The entire crust of the Earth could have been formed in only 500 million years, one half of 1 billion years, 10% of how long they say the Earth has been here. And they say the crust was there 4 billion years ago. So for 4 billion years of volcanic eruptions, how much did the Earth's crust increase? Not at all. Lo and behold, the volcanoes must have just started 4,000 years ago. Isn't that funny? See, that's called the secondary assumption of the evolutionary model. Lo and behold, meteorites must have just started 6,000 years ago. Lo and behold, rivers must have just started flowing 4,000 years ago. 6,000 years ago. See how absurd and silly? How about if you take out a compass? I took a course at Arizona State University, outdoor survival. We had to do an overnight in the Sonoran Desert, alone with no tent, no sleeping bag, virtually no food, virtually no water. And it was pretty wild. You hear those coyotes howling all night long, and you're sitting there all alone in the middle of the desert for 4 credits. It wasn't worth it. But anyway, you know, we learned how to use a map, quadrangle maps from U.S. geological surveys, and a compass, and figure out, you know, how to find out where you are and how to get to where you want to go. Compasses work. Why do compasses point north? It's because the Earth has a magnetic field. Well, how is it that the Earth has a magnetic field? There are attributes. An entity can't just have a magnetic field. It has to have certain attributes. And to have the magnetic field as strong as the Earth's, so that it would take a little metallic needle and a compass in your hand and spin it around and point it north, the Earth has to have a pretty strong magnetic field. Well, where does it come from? How do you generate a magnetic field? Well, one way is to use an electric current and to have that electric current circle something. You could make, your children could make an electromagnet for a science project in school and take wires and make a coil and run electricity to it, and lo and behold, you made a magnet. Well, the way that our Earth has a magnetic field is generally held by textbooks and universities considering magnetism, is that the Earth has an iron core, and there's a huge amount of electricity that is circling the iron core of the Earth, and that turns the Earth into an electromagnet. But when that happens, friction causes heat, and heat dissipates usable energy. So the amount of electricity that's flowing around the Earth, that would lessen and lessen over time. Like a battery running a generator and the generator charging the battery. Eventually it all wears down. Wears down pretty quickly. Well, the magnetic field of the Earth, is it totally stable or is it getting weaker? It turns out it's getting weaker. And this has been studied very carefully, again, by scientists now for about 150 years, measuring the magnetic field of the Earth. And they found out that it has a half-life of about 1,400 years. In other words, 1,400 years from now, the magnetic field of the Earth will be half as strong as it is right now. So if you have a cheap compass that you got in a Cracker Jack box, and the field is barely, but it just barely is strong enough to move that needle, but hardly. Well, you give it to your great-great-great-great-grandkids, and the magnetic field will be weaker, and that cheap compass isn't going to work. What if you go backwards? What if we go 1,400 years ago? Well, then the magnetic field would be twice as strong as it is right now. 28 years ago, it would be four times as strong. 5,600 years ago, it would be eight times as strong. Wow, 11,200 years ago, it'd be 16 times as strong. Wow, that's pretty interesting. 22,000 years ago, 32 times as strong. Is that possible? You get to just a few tens of thousands of years ago, and the Earth would have had to have a magnetic field as strong as a magnetic star, and that's not possible. It's not possible. So when we look at the magnetic field of the Earth and its strength, we realize it's decaying. That's another geochronometer, that the Earth is not all that old. There are many valid geochronometers that we can use to estimate how old the Earth is. But scientists will tell you, oh, we date the rocks. How do they date the rocks? Do they do it based on appearance? No. On whether it's a shale or a granite or a limestone? No. On the structural feature, whether it's crumbly or solid? No. Do they do it based on what rocks are juxtaposition next to it, above it, or below it? No. Do they date them radiometrically, generally? No. How do they date them? They date them by index fossils. They find out, well, what fossils were in that rock? And they don't look at all the fossils. They look at certain fossils, and they say, well, we know when the pig evolved. And so since this rock was found with the pig bone, well, then we know how old the rock is. They don't know how old the rock is. Did a supernova exploding 10 billion years ago or more, did it create the elements, the primordial elements, that swirled in a cloud and eventually became our sun and our solar system? Is that where all the elements of our Earth came from? Well, first of all, as I believe we mentioned in the last class, the law of angular momentum, if this cloud is spiraling, as they say it was, and then out of that cloud forms the solar system, then everything in the solar system would have to be spinning in the same direction. The angular momentum of the entire solar system would be maintained, and even if things collided, they would still be spinning in the same direction. Now, the sun is rotating in a certain direction. The planets revolve around the sun in that direction. Many of the planets revolve around their own axis in that direction. But a couple of the planets revolve the other way. Some of the moons have a reverse revolution, and they orbit backwards. Now, that is not just an uncomfortable fact for evolutionists. That kills their theory. There is a dead solar system evolutionary theory out there. It is not doable according to the laws of physics. But let's just say, let's ignore that problem, and let's say they're right. This supernova exploded and created all the elements that make up our solar system. All the helium, and all the hydrogen, and the uranium, and the lead, and the on and on and on and on. Thorium, everything you need, it's all there. The radon, it was all created. Well, there are certain elements that decay. They're radioactive decay. Like uranium, for example, 238, the atomic weight of this uranium atom, we call it uranium-238, it decays very slowly. It takes 4 billion years for half of it to decay. Like if you have a pile of 1,000 uranium-238 atoms, 4 billion years later, 500 of them would have decayed, and you're left with 500. Some things decay very rapidly, like polonium. Polonium exists in three different forms. Polonium-218 decays in 3 minutes. So if a supernova created polonium-218, all the polonium would disappear within minutes, while this thing was still thinking about swirling to become a solar system. So how is it that we have proof that polonium-218 existed in the Earth when it was created? Now, how can we have proof of that? I'd like to show you pictures of it. For those listening on tape, you can order a book from Bible Discount in Denver or any bookstore in the country for the most part, called Creation's Tiny Mystery by Robert Gentry. Gentry is a scientist who's worked at our national laboratories. He's been published in refereed scientific journals that if I were to read the titles to you, you'd recognize them. Well, he was searching in these laboratories for halos formed by polonium-218. And here are actual photographs of his halos. He published this material in publications like Nature and Scientific American. And you don't find a couple polonium halos in the basement rocks of the Earth. You find millions. You can crack open a one-inch square piece of rock and find hundreds of polonium halos. 218. Now this polonium decays in 3 minutes from when it was created. How in the world could it get in the solid granite hundreds or thousands of feet down into the crust of the Earth? How can it get there? Because whatever polonium-218 would have been created in that supernova bang would be gone, because they say it took the Earth a billion years to, it was swirling molten nothing. But these halos are perfect spheres, perfect circles, which indicate what? That the polonium was placed inside solid granite, and then it decayed rapidly within minutes. And as it decayed, radioactively, it stained the rock around it. So what are those polonium halos? Effectively, they're the fingerprints of God. God showing us, proving scientifically, that the Earth geologically did not gradually form over millions or billions of years, but He created it, He spoke it into existence. And when He decided, He formed the foundation basement rocks of the continents. And He formed them instantly. This book is absolutely fascinating. When you believe that the Earth was created just 6,000 years ago, then you go through life observing. You look at the information that comes across your path. And you would think at every turn, on every day, they make hundreds of discoveries to prove that you're wrong. But the opposite is true. They say that stalactites and stalagmites take hundreds of thousands of years to form. Then they find them in man-made tunnels in different places around the Earth. The same geology makeup as ones that supposedly took forever to form. Mount St. Helens proved that canyons, the likes of the Grand Canyon, a huge scale model of the Grand Canyon, Engineer's Canyon at Mount St. Helens, formed what, in thousands of years or tens of thousands? No, in hours. And we have the photographic evidence for it. Now you don't see it, now you do. A canyon occurring rapidly. The evidence is overwhelming, scientifically and biblically, that we have a very young Earth and we can believe the Bible.